Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of the Creating Structure Podcast. Great to be back with you. I'm John Wheaton, your host. My pleasure today to have with me Dan Shields, president at Fabricated Products Group. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hey, John. Happy to be here.
Great to have you. And it's been a while since we talked, and I'm really, really pleased to reconnect with you. So let's jump right into it. Why don't you tell the audience who you are, where you're from, what your background is, and we'll get into this.
Yeah. So my name is Dan Shields. I'm from Chicago. And it's, when I say I'm from Chicago, I am from Chicago. Well, there's a running joke here. Anybody that is in the surrounding suburbs, the farther that you go away from the city, you still say that you're part of it. But I was born and raised in the city, and then moved out to the suburbs when I was in my teens, late teens. Went to grammar school in the city, the Catholic high school to start. And then I transferred into, when we moved out to the suburbs, I transferred into Samberg High School, which is a public high school in Palos. That's kind of how I got into this industry. When we transfer into schools, they team you up with a transfer buddy. So I was 15, and my transfer buddy happened to be the oldest grandson for the trainers.
So I was able to cut my teeth in trainer glass.
Yeah, so I don't know too many people that said that they wanted to get in glass and glazing. We kind of all fell into this world. I am no different. I fell into it. And it started off sweeping floors and breaking down crates and doing whatever a 15-year-old is allowed to do on a worker's permit. So that's kind of how I got my taste of what glass and glazing and building enclosures, what this world was all about. Went to college at DePaul University. Stayed in Chicago. It's hard to get away from here. And I studied business, core competency, and leadership. Got out. I was working at a law firm while I was going in. When I was at DePaul, I was actually considering changing my major to business law. Right there, and the law firm was a business law firm, so everything seemed to fall into place. And there was a couple. They were a defense attorney, and they lost a couple big cases. And a lot of us college kids were given pink slips, and we were looking for jobs. And as a result of that, and having bills to pay and books to pay for, the job that I had prior to that was trainer. So I went back to see if I can sweep floors and pound vinyl and do whatever I can, and just to have a job underneath. And then the rest is history. So I graduated college and was working in the shop, and got to where I'm at now. And I'm sure we can kind of go through my path to where I'm at now. But
yeah, we will. That's good. There's already some really good stuff in there. So I am from Chicago as well, but I've lived in Ohio since I was 8 years old. I was born at Doctor's Hospital in Berwyn, Illinois.
Okay.
In Chicago. And so you were born and raised in Chicago, but as a teenager, you moved out to the south suburbs. And I'm really interested in when you transferred to Samberg High School, a transfer buddy. I've never heard of that before. So they literally partner you with somebody who.
You get a friend.
Like, here's an instant friend. Did those kids volunteer, or did they just pick them?
No, it was just, it's just a group of all the transfers for that year for your class. So I was transferring as a sophomore, and we were in a big room, and they're just pairing kids up, and this is your transfer buddy. That was the title, as a transfer buddy, and mine was Ken Kuzmal. His dad is still in the industry, Steve.
Steve Trainer?
Steve Kuzmal.
Steve Kuzmal.
His wife is a trainer.
Right.
It's the sister of Bob and the rest. So, and Ed, Tom, and those guys. So yeah,
interesting.
Yeah. So my transfer buddy, his family was in glass and glazing since the 50s, and they needed some high school kids to come and clean up the yard. I mean, it was just, I mean, it could have been anything, but it just happened to be glass and glazing. So
I love it. I love it. I love it. That's really good. Forgive me for my ignorance here. Did you actually work for Trainer Glass when you got out of college, or did you go straight to U.S. Aluminum, or did you work for, like, where did you
go? So I actually went to Duralco, which was a sister company of Trainer Glass.
They had some ownership interest in that?
It's a little bit different than what I'm dealing with now. We'll get into that. But, there was overlap of ownership there.
Gotcha.
So I think that they called it a sister company, but I think it was more of a – there was some separation. I wasn't privy to how that all took place, because when things changed for Trainer, Duralco was still there, but then they sold and they created – now there's something different now. When I came back out of college, there's an opportunity there over at Duralco in the shop. And I went over there and was a saw operator cutting metal for them.
Really?
It was just, it was like I said, it was really I was having fun as a kid and racked up a bunch of bills and I had to pay them off. So and that was an opportunity to do that.
That's a great
And on the weekends I sold cars.
And you sold cars on the weekends?
Yeah.
I could picture that.
That's how I just broke even. Yeah.
Derek Losey, who you may know, the vice
president. I know Derek.
Oops. Yeah, of Steel Encounter. He shared a similar story on the podcast. He was pushing broom and taking orders on weekends, and just moved through it. Like you say, I don't know that any of us pick this industry. It picks us, doesn't it?
Yeah, and Brian Clark over at Harman, he has a real similar story about pushing brooms and stuff. And I worked for Brian when I started. He was already moving up in the company and stuff. And when we tell our stories, it follows the same.
That's great.
At least in the shop part. Once you get in the office, everything else moves. But he was always somebody I looked up to and saw that he was able to make those big strides. So
that's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us a little bit about you. Give us a little background. Let's jump to President at Fabricated Products Group, because I know you had a path. I do like to know a little bit about your history. I'll tell you what, before President of Fabricated Products Group, which is where you are now, just talk a little bit about just how did you get from Duralco to Alliance to IDA? What was that path like? Was there anything unique to your capabilities there that how did that transpire? Talk just a little bit about your history and ascension in the industry.
Yeah, so in my college career, when I started off, I didn't know what I wanted to be when I grow up. I'm still not sure I do, but I studied everything that I could just to find the path. And I took a lot of I took architectural classes, I took a lot of engineering classes, I had a strong math and science acumen, so I gravitated towards those subjects and thought that I wanted to do something with that. So I was able to, I took AutoCAD for fun just to learn it. And then because I took so many different classes, it was hard to really focus on what the major should be. So that was a challenge for me. But through all of that, I felt like I was kind of a jack of all trades, master of none. And I wasn't scared to try something new. So going to Duralco and working in the shop and working the Elu double miter saw, there was, I'll figure it out. And I played around with that. And then I got into all the things that Duralco was doing and the sunshade and architectural grill world, and was able to read drawings right out of the gate. So that was beneficial to at least understand what was going on and not just, here, cut all these pieces to this size. I was really looking at what's this doing? Where's it going? How's this fitting in? Truth be told, I wanted to be an architect when I was a kid. I don't know why that never really materialized, but I've always had that itch to scratch. So it kind of gave me an opportunity to do that, an outlet, which was kind of neat. And then there was, you know, as projects come through and the bigger projects come through, you start to question why things are the way they are. Why don't we have all the material that we need? Why are we redoing things? You know, you start questioning, like, is project management really doing their job well? And, you know, you have that natural fight between the shop and the PMs, and nobody really knows each world. And I guess in that, I saw there was an opportunity for project management, and that I immediately took it. So I moved up into to project management for Duralco and found success pretty quickly. Ran at one point, I was running 84 projects at the same time, and it's 84 architectural calls, 84 clients, 84 sets of submittals, 84 material orders, to the point where we were hiring more PMs. Duralco was really taking off, and so I got to work with other project managers and train them. And while we were doing that, we were executing well, and I was building relationships with the end, the client, the building enclosure contractor. More often than not, it was a glazing contractor. So I was building a reputation of somebody that could follow through on what they say they're going to do. And that naturally turns into a sale at some point. And I told you I sold cars, so I had a little bit of sales training and had no problem talking to strangers. Now I'm talking to people I know, and that's so much easier. And we were getting opportunities to look at stuff, and estimating and sales was busy. And so I was helping out in that world. And before I knew it, Tom O'Malley was, who you know really well, Tom O'Malley was needing sales, and I went and worked for Tom. And that's when I really fell in love with the industry, was from that perspective. So I think that because I was in the shop physically cutting and fabricating material, and then going into project management and making sure that, you know, all the ancillary stuff is taken care of, because I really think that's where project management falls apart. It's not the big stuff, it's the little things, you know, the attention to detail. I mean, when you bring all that into the sales world and you have that, you know, you give that client that warm fuzzy that you know what you're doing and you're able to get it done, makes it easier. So that's how I got into sales. And then from there, because I studied business with micro competency and leadership, it, you know, getting into the management side was a natural progression for me. So I went from Duralco. I was there for 10 years.
Yeah.
When I came back. And I probably would still be there had I not taken a phone call during a lunch. I never really listened to competitors or other opportunities or headhunters or anything like that. I was happy where I was at, but so being there 10 years, I was talking to, I'm not going to name too many names, I don't want to get anybody in trouble, but I was on this call and I said, no, I like where I'm at. I've got 10 years experience here. And the message was, do you really have 10 years experience or do you have 5 years? You just did it twice. Well, and at that point, I had to stop and think about, am I being challenged? And at that time, you know, I was just doing the sales thing. I didn't see any opportunity for leadership roles and moving up. And so I decided that I needed to try something different. And that's the only reason why I left. I mean, I loved working with all the people there and it was having fun. It was easy for me. But I don't know that it was really challenging what other skill sets I had. And I really wanted to get to the leadership part. So that was kind of the driver of looking elsewhere. And U.S. Aluminum was an opportunity to take a management position in the sales arena. So I had 13 direct reports. I had from Manitoba east to Canada, and then I basically had from Illinois to New York, and then I had basically all the way down to Texas. So we did big.
Wow.
We didn't go all the way down to Texas, down to Tennessee, but we had a big chunk of North America, and having 13 professionals selling in different markets, in different. I mean, it was a, and then the 3 days after I took the job, and I knew this coming in, so it wasn't a shock, but they filed Chapter 11. So it was being able to lead a team in a environment like that, when it's PR rollouts and just trying to deal with just the internal struggles that you go through on that. It was something you'll never learn in a textbook.
No.
So it was an opportunity that I went in head on. My boss at the time, Dave Tomchek, he was always transparent on what we were doing and where we were headed, and made me comfortable enough on at least taking that with him, taking that head on. And we successfully got through the Chapter 11. Chicago was actually getting close to, I think they were in the black, but there was something that just didn't feel right. It felt like the company was getting ready for a sale at some point. Like, okay, we got it to where we can go ahead and sell it. So I immediately was just, I got to get out of this, because the Chapter 7, I don't know if I want to figure that one out. And then I went over to Alliance Glazing. So then now, for all the way up until this point, I was on the manufacturing side. I was supplying product systems to glazing contractors, metal panel contractors, building enclosure contractors. And this Alliance was my first taste of the other side of that negotiation. So now it's general contractors and business managers and the like. So that was a unique 5 years, and probably a very important move for me because of what it brought to how I can sell now with what we're doing here at FBG. So IWR came right after Alliance. So while I was at Alliance, and you know this, John, because of our dealings with each other, there was an opportunity to do a job down in St. Louis. We teamed up with IWR, went after the full enclosure, and met the team down there, and I fell in love with that company and how they're built. They have a long history since 1895. The parent company goes back to.
That's amazing.
Family and faith based, and it just felt like home every time I went there.
And
not that Alliance wasn't great to me, and it wasn't that I didn't like being there. Just something was there at IWR that I had to be part of. And at first I thought it was because of the job and because of just going through that battle of the sale, because that was a long, choreographed process to get to the finish line. And those are the sales efforts that I like being part of, those really big, complicated sales, long sales process. And I thought it was that, but there was a couple other small opportunities that we did together, and those were just as much fun. And then I realized it really was the people there that I liked interacting with. And I thought, I'll bring a couple of them over to Alliance. Well, they won the tug of war, and I wound up going over there. So I was at IWR and was the vice president of sales there. We started a glazing division. It's going on almost 8 years now ago, 7-8 years ago. We started a glazing division down there. And then there was this company that MHS Legacy had since like 1967, called Fabricated Products. And it was mothballed. It was off to the side. They weren't really doing anything with it. There's a unique story how I found out about that. But the short version is we had like this pep division that I was running, and it was just making ancillary items for IWR so they could be successful. And I was doing that while we were selling work, and that started to kind of turn into something that had some nice margins to it, and we were running it well, and we're like, how do we do more of this?
Yeah.
And because of my history of being on the manufacturing side for a decade and plus, I was like, well, I'd like to do this. I didn't realize how passionate I was about the manufacturing side.
Yeah.
You know, and to come back to it was something that I was like, I definitely would like to experience that. So left IWR to start this, but it was underneath the MHS umbrella, so I can still stay with that family and all
still
those
in the same culture, same family.
Yeah, we brought that culture here, and we spent a lot of time making sure that we don't dilute it as much as it naturally does.
Yeah.
So when we have somebody from MHS come, you know, visit us here and then visit IWR, it feels the same.
Mm-hmm.
You can see a lot of the same SOPs in place, and you know, we've learned under the same teaching. So you could tell that there's a familiarity there. So we're sister companies, I would say, more than I think Duralco and Trainer were.
Yeah,
because the only thing that we share with IWR is IT and HR, and then accounting. But we have different banks, the fiduciary relationships different. I mean, it's the way that it's structured is IWR is a client of mine.
Right. You're under the MHS banner, but IWR is a client, separate P&L, I'm guessing, and all that.
The whole thing, yeah. We're not privy to each other's information, and it was really important that when we built this that, you know, we were completely separated from that, because this industry is very incestuous. Because it's, you know, like we said, nobody really wants to come in here. We all fell in here. And people just, as they grow, other companies will take and give. So if we played games like that, it would get money real fast. And the success of FPG would fall pretty quick.
Yeah.
We had a bunch of people that left IWR and went to Harman, right? And then I go to sell the Harman, the first thing would be like, oh, well, they play numbers games or something like that. So it's important for us to keep that separation. The industry's got a lot of that. I mean, you got Apogee and Viracon and Harman, right? Like there's, you know, you have a holding company and then you have separate companies. And, you know, our focus is to really help the industry out and not just IWR.
Yeah, I get so many questions and so many comments that circle back. That's so good. The first one is, well, first a comment, it'll lead to some things. Just bear with me here. So as you talked about your protection, it makes complete sense to me. I don't think we could overemphasize the importance of you having experience behind the saw in the shop, packing material, cutting material, doing project management, understanding how that's connected to the quality there, and then getting to sales and estimating how that's connected to the project management. And of course, then full circle around your experience now as president, it's combining all those things, all those client types, all those components, all those experiences. It makes complete sense, and I'll get back to that, but I really love, I guess for those listening, you know, doesn't matter whether you got a college degree, master's or bachelor's or not, being willing to go down a path and try new things. Oh, like you weren't above working in the shop. Why would you be? You had bills to pay, but it led to unexpected positive consequences. So I love that, Dan. That is just... I didn't know that about you. That's really inspiring. And it's really hard. I think it's really hard to hire into a sales position and just all of a sudden go sell. Like you've got to know something about the client and the product and the service, right?
Yeah, I think that helped. I never thought of myself as a salesman.
No.
You know, it has like this negative connotation to it anyway. It's like, oh, the shiny pants salesman, you know? I was like, no, I'm a project manager. Like, I'm a manager. I kept on saying, I'm not a salesman. But I was selling. It felt natural for me. It's just like, well, hey, this is what it costs for me to do the job. You need it done. Let's get it done. You know, I didn't feel like I was selling them on anything. I felt like I was providing something for them. And I think that difference between myself and some of the people that I work with that are no longer selling.
I would describe that, what you just talked about, and you, to me, you're a problem solver, like a creative problem solver. Yeah, like the point of sales, that's just a consequential outcome to delivering a solution with a price attached to it. I don't care what you're doing. Like, it's you don't have to work at the sell, at the actual sell. That's just when you get to that point, it's like, oh, this makes sense. Let's sign a purchase order or let's send it. So, yeah, that's really beautiful. I don't know. I don't think I would underestimate, for those who haven't done it, I don't think I would underestimate the emotional energy involved in staying on top of all those spinning plates and selling and following through on all the iterative processes in negotiation, right? Yeah, you're right. I don't know how many of us are really, quote, salespeople.
Yeah,
we just happen to sell a solution.
Yeah, we look at it as a process, the sales process.
Right.
We're just part of it.
Right.
Everybody in the company is a salesman.
Yeah.
You know,
you're service and product.
Yeah, you have touch points, right? When I was a project manager, I was selling every time I talked to the client about what we were. I was really big on the communication between us and our clients. I didn't like delivering bad news, but I knew I had to do it earlier than later.
Yeah,
and I think that was another thing that kind of got me in a position of trust with a lot of people, because everybody has issues. It's just how you handle those. And you're talking about troubleshooting, and that literally is what it is. And it's much easier to do as part of a team. They have the ability to react to it or plan it, you know, ahead of time. There's an analogy I use with, you know, anytime we get a new hire in and we're trying to convey that message of delivering news early. You know, if you had your car broke down and you had to drop it off at a mechanic to get fixed, and your spouse took the day off of work with you, you dropped the car off just so you had to ride back to work. Car is dropped off on Tuesday. They tell you it's going to be ready next Tuesday. Good deal. So I have to manage this for a week. You kind of plan that all out. And then Tuesday comes around, your spouse takes another day off of work to drop you off to go pick up the car. She's pulling away and you're standing there, and the manager comes out and says, you know, John, I'm real sorry. The part didn't come in and it's not going to be ready until next Tuesday. Well, now your wife that just took a day off of work is already a couple miles down the road. It's a circle back. You're upset because you're standing there waiting for a ride to get back to potentially deal with what you just, if they would have called you on Friday and said, John, you know, the part's not coming in, I really, you know, I apologize for it, supply chain issues, but it's going to be the following Tuesday, the same end result, but your emotion to get to that result has gone through a much different path. And I think that you look at them differently as a result. So when we approach our business here, it's when we have that message, call on Friday and deliver that message. It's not fun. I mean, nobody likes having to get another rental car for another week or whatever it is. But at the end of the day, I mean, this is what we have to deal with, and it's much easier to do it, you know, out and up front and out in the open. So,
that's a great story, a great analogy. Yeah, it reminds me of that. I haven't had the conversation for a while, but, you know, I don't believe any client or customer, like, and we all have relationships with people. Everybody expects that there's going to be problems. Nobody expects perfection, but they do expect clarity and transparency and communication. Like, that to me, and you know, we've failed at this before. Like, there's nothing worse than, you know, you call up your team on Thursday, 5 o'clock. Hey, how are we looking for that submittal at noon tomorrow? Oh, we're not going to make it. What do you mean you're not going to make it? It's going to probably be Monday or Tuesday. Wait. I just had to find this out, you know, or whatever it is. And then and I know that, you know, we fixed that quite a long time ago here, but I think customers, I know I appreciate it when somebody calls and goes, listen, got a problem. Here's what we're going to do. You can count on us to deliver it. It just is what it is. And there's
well, you bring up a really good point. I mean, if you're finding out about the issue versus them telling you, then there's that layer of, are they really on top of it?
Oh,
or
for sure.
Am I managing this for them?
And then how deep does one have to dig?
Yeah.
Because when I go to
the material, right?
When I go to the dealer that doesn't have the part, the analogy is using it, like, I want to go back into operations now with them, or I want to talk like, how come? You mean you guys didn't know? Well, then what tells me it's going to be delivered next Tuesday? How much longer is it really going to? Like to your point, it creates distrust. It creates doubt. And you may never get another opportunity with that person ever. That it could be a one and done.
Right. So we look at that as the bare minimum. And then the next thing is, how do you continue to improve a process? And in that same analogy, not only do we call you on Friday, but we should call you on Friday with a potential solution to the problem.
Yeah.
You know, hey, John, your car is not going to be ready until next Tuesday. I know that you probably have to get to work for the next week. We have a loaner vehicle here. We'll have it dropped off at your house.
Exactly.
Right? That's the next step, right? It's the same thing in our industry. It's like, what's the next step to that process? So, okay, we have a supply chain issue. Here's potential solutions, right? So that way you're providing some path forward. And it might be, the solution might be, we're going to just wait. And it's fine. Sometimes you uncover that the client was building in all this buffer time anyway.
Yeah, right.
And sometimes it's not there, but you know the point is that you'll flush that out and work on that solution as a team. And I think that's a better approach than just calling them on Tuesday and saying sorry. So
that's a great conversation, Dan. Thanks for that, and thanks for your just discussion about your trajectory and all those nuggets there. There's a few nuggets that I wrote that I'd like to just. We may not come back to them, but you said I wasn't scared to try something new. I really love that. Like 10 years at Duralco, you picked up a call during lunch. That could probably be a whole podcast in and of itself. you get a call at lunch and they planted that seed with you. Do you really have 10 years? That's great. But the fact that you weren't afraid to try something new, from the saw to the estimating to the leadership position. So that's really good. I know there's a number of things we want to get to. I want to know a little bit more about Fabricated Products Group. And I also, you know, we talked a little bit just about some current issues in industry related to supply chain and contract provisions and such. So let's talk about Fabricated Products Group. I'm really impressed that, you know, here MHS is over 100 years old. I'm really impressed that they had this group sitting off to the side. Obviously, they owned the rights to this group or the naming or whatever from 1967. And you're saying that nothing was really happening there. So you say you started kind of doing it on the side.
It's actually a funny story. So how FPG began wasn't that we were going through. So MHS over 125 plus years has gone through many companies. And their success has been attributed to many things. But one of them is the fact that they get into different industries when they're hot, and when they're, you know, as they start to not be, they divest from them. And they had insulation companies and scaffolding companies and roofing companies and metal panel companies and now glazing companies, and they've done so many things over that time. And the Fabricated Products company that they had in 1967 was doing machining. Just, they were a machine shop. They were just called Fabricated Products in St. Louis. They were a machine shop, a local shop that you brought in design, they made it, whatever. So I don't know a lot about that company from 1967. I just know that they had the rights on Fabricated Products. What we were doing, it was just IWR. It was just this little, like, hey, Dan, can you manage this? So they divested from a company that did phenolic. So it's like, so they, like the Trespa panels, they did furniture, you know, lockers and things like that.
Yeah.
They divested from that as I was coming into IWR. And there was a division of that company that was very profitable. And it was nothing to do with building enclosures. I don't know how they got it. They've been doing it for 50 plus years. Again, MHS getting in all these other industries. So it didn't make sense to let that part of the company go, because what they were selling was the was the phenolic side. They weren't selling, this is a calcium silicate side. So calcium silicate boards that are machined down for different components to the HVAC systems and the like. So they were like, hey, Dan, can you help just manage this? We're going to keep this. And that's how it started. So that company has a table router, has panel saws. They had a shirt break right there. So I had all these pieces of a miter saw. I have all these pieces of equipment that I grew up around. When I started in 15, I swept underneath these machines, right?
Yeah. So,
like, I knew what they were, and they weren't being used. And, you know, it started off like, hey, can you guys make this for a job that we got going for IWR? Can you do this? Can you do that? And meanwhile, we were focusing on that calcium silicate company, and we wound up growing it like 20 to 30%. And then the 2 years that when we did the analysis on it, it was like, man, you know, when we focus on something that was high margin, this thing was just off to the side. It wasn't huge revenue, but it was very profitable on what it did. So when you focused on it, it grew. And it's like, okay, so there's something here. And that was the catalyst to maybe take all this equipment. What can we do with it? Naturally, for me, it's like, I like building enclosures. I've been part of this world for a long time. I want to stay in this world. And I think that we could provide more to the industry if we started focusing on that. Not necessarily getting rid of the calcium silicate stuff, but really focus on the metal side, the custom metal side. So we sat in a room and we came up with all these adjectives of who we were, and it was, fabrication and manufacturing, and we had all these lists and we were highlighting words, and it came out to products, fabrication, and group. And we put FPG together, fabricate products group, we got it set up. And then when we're talking to the owner of MHS, he's like, oh, so we're just taking our old company and start. I'm like, and I thought it was a joke, and turns out it just happens to be the same name.
That is amazing.
Yeah, so we got there.
I love that.
Yeah, so we've been around since 1967. We're not lying. We have been.
That's wild.
But this focus, what we're doing, is really the last 5 years with this group here. And
that is a fantastic story.
Yeah. So
when you say you're a custom fabricator specializing in design, engineering, manufacturing with premium architectural systems and components, what kind of things are you guys making?
So all the ancillary stuff on the exterior of the buildings, that all the pretty stuff, right? So we're doing a lot of screenings in parking garages, architectural grills, sunshades. We're kind of like the Orange County Choppers of the building enclosure components. So what we like to do is we understand and we appreciate the architect's vision of what they want and the uniqueness that they want to bring to that building. We also understand our clients of the subcontractor, their need to be able to install something efficiently. And then we also understand the owners, want to keep the cost down as much as they can. So what we try to do and what we feel that we're really good at is getting into those situations, whether it be a design assist or FPD, whatever that is, very early on, and help develop the system without compromising the architectural intent. And I think that's kind of our claim to fame. So we're very custom. I haven't done the same job yet here. I don't have a system sitting on the shelf and saying, here's my system. We'll go ahead and change it a little bit and fit it into your building.
Yeah.
What we have is proven systems that we've done in the past. And we might borrow the chassis from it or whatever, components that made it work that we know that we can rely on and build from there. But it really is all about maintaining that architectural intent, giving them something they can install and something that's within a reasonable budget. And that's, because of the last 10 years of the industry, and that's the part that I've really enjoyed and being part of. That's kind of our focus. So those are the components that we do. So it's a lot of, it'll be turnkey. It'll engineering, shop drawings, delivered to the site. We just don't install. So we sell to the installers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and excuse me, is it all architecturally exposed visible stuff, or are you also doing, you know, coping, brake metal, anchors, shear blocks cut to length? Like, are you doing everything, or are you mostly focused on the exposed visible aesthetic pieces?
So because we have the capacity and the equipment and the personnel that can do it, we get brought into a lot of the components that you don't see. We're doing a lot of steel anchors. You know, you have a, it's only because we know the industry. It's the same clients, and you know,
yeah,
we tell them, if you can't find it, give us a call. We probably can make it for you. Because we have the equipment to do that here. We have a 5-axis CNC here. We can weld ferrous and non-ferrous here. So there's a lot of capacity, and we wind up finding ourselves into doing all these custom shapes. They're one-offs, to the point where we're creating a division for that stuff. So eventually there will be like an FPG steel or whatever we wind up calling it to do TNF anchors and couple components and clips and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Field buyout parts. So if you look at our website, you'll see a tagline like, we have breakneck turnaround. We know this industry so well that we understand how fast paced it is and how schedules can slip. And if you don't have what you need when you need it, it can really snowball. And I've been on many projects where you've ordered 120 clips and it's 120 on the packing slip, but the guy counted it three times. There's only 110 in that box, right? And you don't know where the 10 went, but you need them tomorrow. And we're getting those calls because we can execute really fast on that stuff, because a lot of it is just machining. You know, they're standard shapes that we can get, or we can weld up something, fashion something up to satisfy that. So there might be that division, but I think that we don't want to lose sight of the architectural side. I think that's got to live and be out of to be its own thing. So
that's really good.
Yeah,
I did notice that you breakneck turnaround times, and I've always known you to be a really responsive person. So that's probably in part a reflection of you. You know, just as an aside, before we move on to some hot topics, I don't know if you would agree or not with this. Just tell me, since I've known you and as I'm listening to you now, you wouldn't have to have done what you did. In other words, you seem like a person who just cares and just wants to learn. Like, you are like a sponge. You are always absorbing and processing information. And like, why isn't that happening? Why isn't this like always wanting to fix things, not just take up space? Like, you love to learn, you love to grow. Nothing's below you or above you. Is that an accurate description?
Yeah, I think. Anytime I approach a project, I'm not going to retire in that project. Right. And I'm still halfway through my career. I still got 20, 25 years in front of me. So the way I approach things is I build relationships, because that's going to carry on to tomorrow, not the job. And I focus on what I don't know and try to get some sort of knowledge on it, because I don't like being in those situations. And you probably have noticed this, like in the meetings that we've been together on it, I have no problem standing up and talking in front of people, because I truly don't care if I'm wrong. I'm okay with being wrong. I want to know. I'm there because I don't know. You know, and we're a group of, and when you find out that nobody in the room knows the answer, okay, well then let's figure this out, right? So, and for me, that's what really starts stoking that fire in me, is really just trying to uncover what we're trying to accomplish here. You know, so when you have those very complex situations where you have a lot of different trades, a lot of different products all coming together, and how all of those connecting details point to each other, like, I've always, you know, experienced where this guy says it's his and hit, like, that's where everything fails, is right there, right?
So yeah.
So now we start with that. Like, you know, it's like the elephant in the room. Like, nobody wants to talk about it.
And let's talk about that problem.
Yeah, like, hey, can we just talk about this thing that nobody wants to point to?
I like that. Well, yeah. Like you said, you weren't scared to try anything new, and you're not afraid to confront issues. Were you always that way? Like, were you that way as a 10-year-old? Were you that way as a kid? Were you always like asking questions? Were you always like trying to learn something new?
Yeah, I got hurt a lot. And I'd broken lots of bones, lots of stitches. I was in the doctor's office, so that's where they knew my first name. But when I was there, I was always asking, like, you know, what, like, I cut through an artery, I cut through, and my elbow opened up, and I would like point, is this, so what bone is this? And,
oh, geez.
Not like, yeah, it's a traumatic, but like, all right, it's there, let's talk about it. Like, I guess I've always wanted to ask the questions of things that I don't know. And the more I go into it, the more I realize that I know very little.
I think it's more about the questions you ask than the answers you think you have. And I think if we assume we know little, you really have the advantage. Like, let me say, I don't ever want to be the smartest person in the room. And I'm usually not anyway. But even if I was, I wouldn't want anybody to know I was, because everybody's got something to bring to the table. Like, I don't want to be the smartest person in the room. I want to learn from somebody else. So
I think trying to be the smartest person in the room is acknowledging that everybody has something to contribute.
Well, that's a good point. Yeah.
And bringing that. And I think that you asked how I was as a kid, and I've always felt the need to kind of get everybody excited about something, not necessarily be in charge. Sometimes it just happens naturally, right? Because if you're leading, I think leaders rise to the occasion. I think there's a lot of truth in that statement. But I've always felt like I wanted people to be excited. Let's have fun, right? Like,
you wanted to inspire people along the way, like,
right? And so, when I was going trying to understand what I wanted to be when I grow up, it didn't matter to me as long as that I was able to get up on a soapbox and, get the entire team just pumped up and wanting to run through a wall. Whether that was in the sales process, whether that was in a Monday meeting about a project, like, I just wanted, because there's nothing more frustrating to me is a dead silent room with everybody just not wanting to be there.
No energy. Yeah, no energy.
Zero energy.
I would describe what you're saying as, and I've experienced this with you, it's been a while, but I always do your best to leave the room energy positive, right? Like, you leave the room energy positive. Like, you're right. Yeah, that's really good. I really like that. I was just thinking there's a couple of NBA and NFL teams that could use some of what you're talking about, by the way.
Yeah.
Because I was listening to a GM for a team that I'm a fan of, excusing their playoff loss to a team from New York. Okay, it was the Cavs. And and he's great. He's built a great team. But, he's like, I don't know if it's just PR speak or whatever. I'm not too upset. We've still got a lot we've built here. And when I heard it, I was thinking, we don't care about winning a championship. I go back to when the Golden State Warriors, when Mark Jackson was their coach, and they went to the finals, and he was the NBA coach of the year the previous year. They fired him that year. And they brought in Steve Kerr because he didn't align with their culture. They didn't believe they could win a championship with him. And I'm like, why not be the person that says, we want to win a championship, even if you never do? What's inspiring about lowering the bar? What's the point to that?
There's a lot of truth to that.
Yeah. Anyway, I digress.
So, lower the water, raise the bridge, right?
Yeah, I love it. So, wow, time goes so quick. We talked about some, interesting discussion just about some hot points and some lessons learned. You talked about, I'd love to hear your input on supply chain, lessons learned, things that are important to those maybe in your space, businesses or people in your space that could learn from your experience or from the things that you're seeing. So you want to talk about that for a minute?
Yeah, so before we jumped on here, we had that brief discussion, and I'll just bring it back up. The we started FEG 8 months before COVID happened, and it was a challenge in its own right. But that 8 months prior to that, we were finding a space, we were getting the equipment, building a website, getting all your sales materials together, hiring a team. There's so much that goes involved with starting a company. And about 6 months in, we got all of that taken care of, and we're about to hit the ground running, and we're excited, and everybody's motivated. BEC was our jump off point. Like, we're going to start there, going to Nashville, and we are just going to tear the industry up. And
that's 2020.
And that was a couple of weeks before the famous 2 week shutdown. So we came back, and now we're going to do sales calls. We're going to sit in offices, and we made samples, and we were ready to go. I hired a sales manager, and getting her up to speed. And then all of a sudden, nobody was going to the office, and nobody was letting any vendors come in to do any lunch and learns or any presentations. And projects, meanwhile, are still going, and opportunities are still there, but nobody knows who FEG is. And you can go ahead and broadcast on LinkedIn and on Facebook all you want, but their attention span's about 13/10 of a second. So they're just, there was that challenge there. And I think that our saving grace was the fact that I wasn't new to the industry we were trying to sell to.
Yeah.
So I was able to pick up the phone and to say, listen, I know what I'm doing, done it before. To say, I'm doing this, it was a challenge because we weren't building up our approach to the market like that. And I really think that we kind of got off to a rough start. But hindsight looking at it, I think it forged a really strong foundation to who we are. And to start, we had employees, I had no work, and we're still making payroll, and fortunately we have a strong financial position, but it wasn't just that. We had people that believed in where we were going, and because you can pay somebody but they want to be part of something.
Yeah.
So I think one of the hardest things was keeping a team motivated in a challenging situation. And it's okay to kind of tell your team what's really going on. I think more often than not, and I try to look at how I've, the different companies I work for and the different people I work for and how they kept a lot of things close to the vest. And I, as in the position I am now, I understand why that's the natural approach to things, is not share it, because you're worried about people getting scared and leaving, and then all of a sudden it doesn't happen, and now you got to rehire that position. But now it's tomorrow, so you have to pay more for the same person that you just had, and now your margins go down. And it's like, I get it, but at the same time, you have adults working out there that if they understand, back to that analogy of the car, if you know it's coming, you can work together. It's the same thing. So it was, hey guys, this sucks, right? This sucks, but this is what we're gonna do. We came up with, what can we sell? So we designed a sneeze guard. Now, we can argue all day long the benefits of that. Zero.
Right.
It made people feel comfortable, I guess. And we created a Cadillac of sneeze guards. It was adjustable and it tilted, and you can tighten it. So if you were at a bank, you could head it at a certain angle instead of having just one fixed piece of plexi. Because nobody knew how long it was going to be. We wound up selling, $20,000-$30,000 to a local school district here. And, we fitted their conference rooms and stuff like that. But it kept us busy to allow us to navigate through it. And that was the shop. That wasn't us coming up with a new product. And we had a online store. And we have since just scrapped all that stuff. But I think the lesson that we got out of a complex situation like that was to be vulnerable. It's okay to be vulnerable. And I think that, we haven't had anybody quit yet in 5 years. So I think that's part of the reason why.
Wow. That's really great. I wrote that down. It's okay to be vulnerable. thanks for sharing that. You know, one could say if you started a business right before COVID and you survived through COVID and you're still on that path, you can survive anything. But then again, now we're into something we've never been in before either. And
it's one after the other.
It's one after the other. I think, yeah. I think, you know, tenacity and resiliency are things you don't learn in school. Well, you don't get through school if you're not tenacious and resilient, but
right.
I think that's underestimated too. Talk to me about, we don't have a lot of time left. Talk to me about, have you seen any supply chain issues? Are you still dealing with any supply chain issues?
Yeah,
et cetera.
Yeah, supply chain issues aren't as prevalent as they were a year ago.
Okay.
We had a bunch of issues on the aluminum side. One of the major aluminum extruders went from 6 weeks to a year and a couple months, you know, and that was hard to manage because we had a lot of projects that we secured that was going through that. Wound up calling 47 extruders in 8 different countries.
Wow.
So I get calls at 3 o'clock in the morning. Do you want aluminum? I'm like, no, we're good now. So we've met a couple of new players in the industry and basically have expanded our Rolodex when it comes to that. But one of the things that the supply chain issue thing kind of taught us or a lesson learned from there was more on the contract side. You know, we had an issue with a job that was north of 20 full semi, you know, flatbeds going from here to San Antonio, and gas made the rates go more than double. And the contract, the way that they're written, really doesn't leave a whole lot of room for compensation when it's something that's completely out of your control. It's a global event. So I think that the way that we approach our contract review is through a different lens now. And I think that that's probably something that should have been happening in the beginning, because it seems like hindsight's always 20/20. It seems like that's why aren't you looking at that? But, you know, it's okay, it's not 6 weeks, it's 8 weeks or whatever it is. And the cost doesn't go from, you know, $1.79 a gallon to $5 a gallon overnight. We haven't seen that. So for that to happen, now it's a thing, right? So
yeah, right.
So now we're looking at those provisions to make sure that we're covered.
Are you typically being asked to sign as a vendor, which I hate that term, but as a vendor, as a supplier, are you being asked to sign your customers' terms and conditions, or are you sending them your terms and conditions, or are you having to negotiate depending on the client?
Oh, it depends on the project. So if we're supplying a couple of units and it's part of their system, and no, it's really not. But if like that job down in say 20 flatbeds of material, I mean, we're talking about north of $1 million screening job for us.
Yeah.
That's a contract in itself. And it's not installed. That's just material sitting there. So it's a big job. We had another one here in Chicago that same thing was 40, 50,000 square feet of material. When you start getting the jobs like that, naturally they want to get you more into that fold. And you know, it is a negotiation because a lot of things don't apply to the vendor side. So you're constantly going through it. But,
right.
But, you know, you want to stay away from the, you know, we'll pay you if we get paid type thing. And, you know, so I think it's important to go through that. It's important to understand your client's contractual obligations too, though. If they're willing to share that with you, even if you're not tied to it, understanding it, I think that might just be coming from that side. I think I might be just more cognizant of, hey, I need to understand how you're tied to this thing.
Yeah.
What happens if this happens, and how we protect it?
That's an interesting point, and we could go on and on about that. I won't, but I know whenever I get a contract from somebody, you know, I'm like, hey, I sent my proposal. It has my terms and conditions. It's all there. If you inform me at, like, I always think to myself, like, we're all business owners. I would say that for business owner, like, the thing I actually told my team as a CEO here, the thing I like to do the least is review contract language.
100%.
But I'm actually, they all said, but you're the best one at it. Like, you're good at it. And I can't send it to my general counsel outside of the business. Because first of all, it would take them too long to mark up. And second of all, their job is to de-risk everything. And I would never get a contract signed.
Yeah, either. it's really understand. I've had that same argument.
It's all contextual. And I just wind up reviewing it myself. And there's certain things and I'll be honest, and people that have worked with me know, if a customer, a client sends me their PSA or whatever after the fact, my standard policy is I'm never going to sign that without some markup. There are a few I've seen like, wow, this has obviously been vetted. This is really good. And there's not much there, but boy, I
look at those now as opportunities to have the conversation. I would tell you that in the beginning, I looked at even studying business law, I look at these things cross-eyed. I'm like, what are they trying to do here? Because it's all written to protect whoever that wrote that.
Right.
So naturally you're going through it. It's just a negotiation tool now. You're using this as a starting point. I've seen, we'll ask our clients for a purchase order. When they sign my quote, I'm awesome because I know.
Hey, we're done.
Wait, but we're not in the business to screw anyone over either. Like we're just trying to do the job too,
right?
You know, so like sometimes this stuff just gets in the way, and let's just understand what we're trying to do here. And I think now we look at a contract review with our clients as a team. How do we protect us from the owner and from the GC doing what they need to, you know?
I agree.
Let's not do this. Let's work together on it. And I think
I agree 100%. That is such a great value-oriented perspective. Like I was talking to somebody the other day who's technically a competitor, but I said, no. In this day and age, like I was watching the messaging they were thinking of sending to this other client. And this is a company that we're their sub-consultant partner on some jobs. They're our sub-consultant partner on some jobs. And I said to the president of that company, I'm like, hey, I really like this because we may be competitors, but I don't view it that way. We're collaborators in this shared economy and the knowledge-based economy. We're collaborators. Like, I'm not going to go after the things that, like, I don't have the competence to do those things that I'm buying your services for and vice versa. He's like, here, I couldn't agree more. You know, are there direct competitors out there? Yeah, but to approach it, like you said, as a strategic partnership, how can we collectively protect ourselves from the bigger game? And are we both satisfied? Neither of us is going to get exactly what we want, but you know, you are what you negotiate, right? You are what's in that contract. So that is just spectacular stuff from you, Dan. Thank you. I don't actually know. And I always think BVS Productions, my production team, they're probably thinking, here he goes again. I actually have no idea how long we've been on. I think it's been an hour or so.
Yeah, I think so.
Maybe a little longer. So I know we've got to bring it to a close. Dan, what about personally, what about the human being that is not the president of Fabricated Products Group? There any things like you do like that make you up? Like you're a runner, you run marathon.
I wish.
you do keto, you read books, you have certain routines, you make the bed every day. Like what makes you tick? What do you like to do? What outside of work?
It's funny, like every time I ask this question, I tell people that I have almost a dozen 300 games. They're like, oh, he's a bowler. I don't particularly care for bowling much anymore. I haven't bowled in a year now. I've moved away from it, but I'm known as the bowler for some reason. I don't know why. That's not who I like to identify as. I would say, you know, things that make me tick, I like do it with DIY projects around the house. I built a bar in the basement, and I don't mind getting into something and failing. So I just dive right in, even if I've never done it before. Like a epoxy resins, I was just playing around with that kind of stuff, and so I like fishing. I got a pond in the backyard, so that's fun.
Oh, that's nice.
Nice release there. I do read. I've been doing a lot more audibles, trying to, you know, every evening, my wife and I, we go out for a long walk, and we circle back, and she goes in the house, and then I keep going, and I'll hit another three to five miles. And I'll, what I'll do is I'll throw just walking. I can't run anymore. But I'll throw an audible on now, and it's kind of like I can at least get that part, you know. And a lot of the stuff that I do is more like the motivational stuff or business books and, you know, like Malcolm Gladwell and stuff like that. But my routine is coming in here, and then as soon as I go home, it's cooking dinner. I'm a cook. And I like cooking. My wife does most of the cooking though. But when I get a chance to, like last night, I cooked and I enjoy it. I just don't have a lot of time to do that. So,
is that going to be your repurposed career when you're 65? You're going to be a chef. You're going to be on that chef show, like you're going to be on Chopped or whatever.
Yeah, no, because that environment is crazier than the building enclosure world. I mean, the inside of a kitchen.
Oh my gosh!
Part of that. I like being a messy cook. I like experimenting. I don't care if it turns out good or not. I just want to try it.
I love it.
I have friends that will call me up and be like, hey, how did you make or what ingredients did you use? I give them the list, and then an hour later, they show up at my door and say, can you put it together for me?
For real?
Yeah, for real.
That's great.
So I know I'm good at it. They like eating my food, but I enjoy doing it too. So that's I enjoy watching people's reaction. That makes sense.
Yeah,
it's not so much that, like, I love when someone dives into a meal and is like, holy cow, is this amazing.
That makes sense, though. It actually is aligned with what you said earlier. Like, you like people to get excited. Let's have fun. Let's make it a good time. Let's have a party. What if it's not all drudgery here? Let's do it. And I love that.
Uh-huh.
That's really good. Yeah. Well, do you grill at all?
I do grill quite a bit. Grill, smoke.
Well, it's you probably have seen our craziness. I mean, are you on the glass grill thread with?
I've seen it.
You need to be on that thread with Herring and Bill Sullivan and I and. And
I'm game for sure,
Garrett. Because, like, you know, I haven't really done it well, but that's a great little group.
Yeah, I was grilling last night. I grilled two slabs of ribs.
There you go. I love it. We got Weber Grills and some other people on there. So that'll be great. Well, Dean, it's just been great to reconnect. Great to hear your perspective, your mindset, your energy. Really appreciate you. We're gonna wrap up now. And I'll have everything in the show notes that I need to, the website for Fabricated Products Group, your LinkedIn profile, anything social media related for Fabricated Products Group. Anything else you want to say before we sign off?
No, you know, I think you summed it up well. It was good to connect with you. I appreciate you doing this for the industry. It's, you know, these are the podcasts that I like listening to. So keep doing it. Don't stop, because you are providing value. So I'm just humbled that you let me be part of the Creating Structure podcast today.
Well, thank you. It's been my privilege. So once again, ladies and gentlemen, that is the latest episode of Creating Structure podcast. He is Dan Shields, president of Fabricated Products Group. But far more than that, you can look him up on LinkedIn. Again, it'll be in all the show notes. The links. I'm John Wheaton. I'm the CEO of Wheaton Sprague Building Envelope, Wheaton Sprague Engineering, and host of the Creating Structure podcast. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.